The science of solving crimes has come a long way in recent years. DNA evidence now makes it much clearer who was and was not at a crime scene. As a result, people who have been imprisoned for crimes they did not commit have been set free, but not easily. The criminal justice system puts up quite a fight when faced with the prospect of a conviction being reversed, even when the conviction was in error. That's the story Mark Godsey tells in his book, Blind Injustice. A former prosecutor exposes the psychology and politics of wrongful convictions. Mark Godsey was a federal prosecutor in New York City before he became an activist for the wrongfully convicted. He is the co-founder and director of the Ohio Innocence Project. He's a regular contributor to national news organizations and a professor of law at the University of Cincinnati. Mark Godsey, thanks for joining us today.
Thanks for having me on.
Your second paragraph blew me away. The judge hugged Raymond Toler upon his release from prison?
Yeah, Raymond served 29 years in prison for a rape he didn't commit. And DNA evidence proved him conclusively, absolutely innocent. And, you know, this is one of the examples of a judge who actually got it and was open to the idea of mistakes. And without much of a fight, she ended up releasing him and came off the bench and read him the Irish prayer, and she had a tear in her eye and gave him a hug and sent him on his way. So that was wonderful to see that kind of recognition. And often, you know, wrongfully convicted don't even get an apology. So that was really wonderful.
For all of the times that people ask in such cases, how could this happen? I wonder what your answer was when you were still a prosecutor.
Well, I mean, when I was a prosecutor, I thought it didn't happen. And so, I mean, that's what the first chapter of my book is about, how I went into academia. I became a law professor, and I started off at a different law school than I am now. And they had an innocence project there, and the professor who ran it was on sabbatical my first year. So they sort of said, you know, you're the new guy on the block. You've got a criminal investigation background, so you're going to have to supervise this. And I was very cynical. And I remember going to the first meeting, and the students were talking about this inmate they had visited in prison, and they were, you know, confident he was innocent or confident he'd been wrongfully convicted of rape. And I remember sort of internally rolling my eyes and just thinking, oh, my God, this is a joke. So I had that mentality that unfortunately many prosecutors do, that, you know, we've got the best system in the world and, you know, we don't have innocent people in prison in this country.
So when you were a prosecutor, did you take a rather dim view of innocence projects as they were growing around the country?
Yeah, I mean, I don't think I even paid much attention to it. The innocence movement was relatively new at that point. I was a prosecutor back in the 90s. I finished in 2001. But, I mean, it was getting some media attention. But, I mean, I didn't really, as a prosecutor, I was focused on, you know, doing my job. I wasn't paying much attention to it.
You mentioned that metaphorical eye roll when your students came, convinced of the innocence of Herman May. And what did, in fact, happen in his case?
Well, they did DNA testing, and he was excluded from the crime scene evidence. It pointed to someone else. And so he was exonerated and released from prison. And so it was a huge moment of having to eat crow. I mean, I had sat there and listened to the students tell the stories of how he was a high school senior and the police had come and yanked him out of his classroom and taken him down to the police station and plucked pubic hairs from his groin and sat in the jail cell and puked all night, thinking at the time, well, he's a rapist, so that's what happens, having no sympathy whatsoever. And so when it came back and I realized he was actually innocent, and I'd been very arrogant and closed-minded about that possibility, it was a big, you know, I call the first chapter eye-opener. Because that's what it was. It was a huge eye opener that started me on this journey. Now I've, you know, for the last 14 years, I've run the Ohio Innocence Project, which I co-founded. We freed 25 people from prison who together have served 470 years in prison for crimes they didn't commit. So it was a big turnaround.
So you mentioned that as an eye opener, the Herman May case. I wonder how long though, how much more of a transition was there between discovering that Herman May was innocent and getting to where you actually started the Ohio Innocence Project.
You know, I think that was a huge eye-opener, but it was like gradual over that year. I, you know, again, I was sort of asked to supervise this innocence project. I was very reluctant. I couldn't really say no. I was closed-minded to the idea, but then, you know, Herman May was proven innocent by DNA testing. And shortly after that, there was the National Innocence Conference, which is hosted in a different city every year. And it's the lawyers and exonerees from all around the country. There's hundreds of people there. And as the, you know, temporary director of the one at my law school, I went and attended. And so I think that was also extremely eye-opening because I was going to lectures that were, you know, talking about the flaws in the criminal justice system and the mentality of prosecutors that caused them. And I sort of sat there and continued this transition. So I think it took about a year. I mean, the next year I got the job at the University of Cincinnati College of Law, which is where I am now. And Ohio didn't have an innocence project. And so I was rearing to go to found the one in Ohio a year later. So I think it was a year transition.
So you mentioned the numbers within Ohio, and the Ohio Innocence Project has freed 25 people with close to 500 years of prison time between them. What are the national figures like? Do you know offhand?
Well, you can go to the National Registry of Exonerations. It's well over 2,000. I think it's in the 2,300. And the last couple of years, the number has increased at the rate of about 3 a week. And every single year, the number of exonerations continues to go up. So this is not something that's going away. In fact, as there's more and more notoriety to the problem, there's more people focusing on it. And so there's more and more people being discovered. So that's over 2,000. I think it's like 2,300 or something right now. But clearly over 2,000 have been identified as wrongfully convicted through this innocence movement in the past 25 years. And we know that's just the tip of the iceberg because, you know, in the vast majority of cases, there's nothing an Innocence Project can do to reinvestigate the case. I mean, the primary thing we use is DNA evidence, not exclusively, but that's the primary thing. And what people don't realize is the vast majority of crimes, there's no DNA to test. You know, if somebody, I'm sitting in my house right now, somebody walks down the street and shoots me through the window. You know, the perpetrator didn't leave any DNA at the crime scene. And that's the way, 90 to 95% of crimes are. And so, you know, these 2,000s we've discovered, it's very clear if you pay much attention to it at all that this is just the tip of the iceberg.
Wow. So really, 90, 95% of cases, no DNA involved at all.
Right. And even in the cases where there should be, let's say we look into a rape case or a murder case that's 25 years old, and we know at the time that, you know, DNA was taken from the victim's fingernail scrapings and there were foreign hairs found from the perpetrator at this crime scene. About 75% of the time, when we go back and research those old cases, the police have thrown it away. They've thrown the evidence file away. So you're getting all these exonerations out of just a slim little percentage of people who are lucky enough to have, first of all, it's a DNA type case, but second of all, that the police saved it after all these years.
Wow. Issues with police, with prosecutors, with judges as well, all part of the issues raised in trying to convince people of the innocence of people who the DNA evidence clearly shows are innocent. Blind Injustice is the book by Mark Godsey. We'll come back and talk more with him. And if you'd like to join us, we'll take phone calls and emails from you when we return to the Jefferson Exchange in a minute 10. Back on the Jefferson Exchange on the News and Information Service of Jefferson Public Radio. I'm Jeffrey Riley. Thank you for listening. We're talking to Mark Godsey, who was a federal prosecutor in New York City who once celebrated convictions in key cases. The world has changed a bit for him as he discovered more about innocence projects, and he has now helped co-found one in Ohio, the Ohio Innocence Project, helping free, several dozen people, now two dozen people, from prison in Ohio. When DNA evidence was able to prove that they were not, in fact, close to the scenes of the crime. You can join the conversation as we talk about his book, Blind Injustice, A Former Prosecutor Exposes the Psychology and Politics of Wrongful Convictions. We're on the Jefferson Exchange at 800-838-3760 by phone, by email, jx@jeffnet.org. So we talked about the raw numbers here, and 2,000 to 2,300 people already freed by DNA evidence through the various innocence projects across the country. But obviously this goes way beyond raw numbers, and I guess the biggest surprise for most people is going to be the behavior of people in the justice system. These are people you once called friends and probably still do in many cases.
Yeah, I mean, the thing that was the most shocking for me once I sort of switched sides, I guess you could say, is just the resistance that I got from prosecutors after we've proven someone innocent. I mean, that's what chapter two is about. It's called Blind Denial. And they, you know, I think a lot of these people, like I was, are very proud of what they do. And, you know, they become a prosecutor or police officer to do good. And it becomes part of their psyche. And then so you come back 20 years later and say, hey, man, that case where you got a conviction in the murder case and you've had the newspaper hanging, you know, framed in your office for the past 20 years, that's sort of your trophy. That guy's actually innocent. It's very hard for any human being to accept. And so the human mind sort of goes into denial. One of my first cases was that of Clarence Elkins, who was convicted of murdering his mother-in-law and his niece. And we had just ironclad DNA evidence that he was innocent and ultimately identified the true perpetrator. And the prosecutors just absolutely refused to admit that they had made a mistake. And It just ended up in this long, protracted battle. And so that was, you know, at that point, I was sort of like, what's going on here? I mean, you know, and then I've just seen it in case after case. And so that's one of the things that propelled me to write the book, is to talk about this mentality.
Well, Mark, in the Elkins case, I mean, they just seem to throw up quite a flurry of stuff and some really shaky kinds of hypotheses that, and I'm being generous calling them hypotheses, about how evidence could have gotten in certain places.
Yeah, it's really ridiculous. I'll try to explain it. And the shocking thing is we see this sort of thing all the time. So in the Elkins case, the grandmother was murdered and raped in her home, and there was a six-year-old girl, her granddaughter, spending the night. And the little girl was also attacked. The perpetrator probably thought he killed her. He did rape her. She fortunately survived. I mean, it was just tragic, but she fortunately survived. And we did DNA testing of the grandmother, and there was, you know, vaginal swabs taken by the coroner. And she was not sexually active, so that the male DNA found there would come from the perpetrator. And we found male DNA, and it was not Clarence Elkins. And then we did, we know that the little girl was knocked unconscious by the attacker, and then he removed her underwear. So we did DNA testing on the sides of the underwear where you'd expect to find skin cells, and we found male DNA there as well that was not Clarence Elkins. But even more importantly, it was the same man's DNA profile on both victims, from the grandmother's vaginal cavity to the little girl's underwear. So only one man could put his DNA in those two locations on the night of the attack, and that's the rapist and the murderer. So it was clear he was innocent. You know, it wasn't Clarence. And so what the prosecutors did in response is they actually made the argument that, well, you know, that DNA you found might have been put there innocently through, like, some sort of contamination before or after the murder. You know, the jurors, maybe Clarence Elkins did it. Well, he certainly did it, they argued, but he didn't leave his DNA anywhere. And at trial, maybe one of the male jurors opened up the evidence bags when nobody was looking and put his DNA all over the vaginal swabs and the panties of the little girl. Or, you know, maybe Judy Johnson, the grandmother, you know, shook hands very vigorously with a man before she was murdered. And then she went home that day and she touched herself down there inside her vagina and she rubbed off the man's DNA. And then she touched the little girl's underwear. You know, a six-year-old is too old to be having help, you know, to go to the bathroom, so that doesn't even make sense. But, I mean, I'm sitting there in court and, you know, reading their briefs and listening to these arguments. I'm just like, are you kidding me? This is ridiculous. One of the things we'll see is, you know, the standard rape case where a woman, you know, very sad, will be attacked and raped, and she'll end up testifying at trial, and it's very clear there was one rapist. And then years later, the guy who's been in prison for 20 years, you know, DNA comes back and proves he's innocent. And the prosecutors will say, well, you know, obviously she was mistaken. There was two rapists. So the guy in prison is clearly guilty. He just didn't ejaculate. And his friend who raped him, you know, with him is the one that left the DNA. And that's, they'll say that even when the evidence is clear that there was only one rapist. And so we'll get these, like, sort of really bizarre spinning of the evidence, these forms of denial to keep, you know, to prevent from having to admit that they made a mistake.
So you do, you're a very efficient writer. You compress time nicely, but how much more time and effort did it take then? I mean, once you first put the initial briefs in asking for the DNA evidence to be considered in the Elkins case, did it get to finally get his innocence proven?
Well, I mean, you're not going to believe what happened. I mean, we had the hearing in March of 2005 where we proved him innocent. It took until July for the judge to issue the decision, and the judge actually went along with the prosecutors and said Clarence has to spend the rest of his life in prison. And so he would have potentially stayed the rest of his life in prison, except for the fact that, you know, we had the DNA profile of the person who was the real rapist and murderer. We just didn't know his name, but we had the profile. And so a private investigator named Martin Yant and Clarence's then wife, Melinda, were out, you know, collecting DNA samples of people in the community that they thought could be alternate suspects, they thought might have been the perpetrator. And ultimately, they identified this individual named Earl Mann, who was a sex offender who got out of prison a few days before the murder and rapes and was picked up for another crime a few days after. So these crimes happened during a window of time when Earl Mann was out of prison, and he was living two doors down from the crime scene during that window of time. And what's the most amazing thing is, you know, they identified this guy. So we looked him up on the computer. The Ohio prison system has a database where you can look up everybody in prison. You know, he was back in prison. He was in prison for another crime at that point. And you can pull up his picture, and he looked a lot like Clarence Elkins. But then we saw that he's actually in prison with Clarence Elkins. So there was 30-some prisons in Ohio, and Earl Mann, our suspect, was in the same prison with Clarence. Inside of that prison, there's like 10 different cell blocks. So if you're in cell block A, you have no interaction with anybody in the other cell blocks. But Earl Mann, the suspect, was in the same cell block with Clarence Elkins. And so his wife, Melinda, told him, if you get a chance, collect his DNA. So Clarence went around with a clean tissue in his pocket for weeks and finally saw Earl Mann leave a cigarette butt in an ashtray. And he picked it up. He put it in a book and flattened it so he could get it out through the mail, mailed it to the DNA lab, and it came back and it matched the DNA from the crime scene. The prosecutor still didn't want to admit that they had made a mistake. We got Attorney General Jim Petro involved, who was very fair-minded about it, looked at it and said, yeah, this is kind of crazy. They went and took Earl Mann's blood sample just to verify the cigarette butt, and it did come back and it did match. And they still didn't want to admit that they made a mistake. It took a lot of pressure from Jim Petro before they finally agreed to release Clarence. Ultimately, they charged Earl Mann only after he confessed. Now Earl Mann is serving life in prison for those crimes that Clarence Elkins spent many years in prison for.
And when did Clarence Elkins finally get out?
It was, I think, December of 2005.
Okay, so it was the same year anyway, but months down the road.
Yes, exactly. Yeah.
Mark Godsey is our guest on the Jefferson Exchange. His book is Blind Injustice, his review of what goes on when there's the evidence to prove people innocent and the justice system resists. So you do offer some caveats in the book. You're not a psychologist. You do still support law enforcement people. And you don't discuss systemic racism in the book. Explain that last one.
Yeah, well, obviously, racism is a huge factor that leads to injustice in the criminal justice system. And, you know, we've seen the ideas proliferated from, the new Jim Crow and the documentary on Netflix, 13th, which talks about mass incarceration. And what a huge problem that has become over the past 30 years. My approach was this. I'm focusing on these psychological problems like cognitive dissonance and confirmation bias and different things that investigators and prosecutors suffer from that cause these wrongful convictions. Racism is a huge part of that. But I wanted to focus on first things that people aren't as aware of or not as discussed. Secondly, racism is such a problem that if I went into it, it would basically dominate the book. And finally, I sort of thought about it. It's like, you know, people think they're not racist. Everybody thinks they're not racist. So if you tell people up front, this is a book about racism, they're going to say it doesn't apply to me. But I wanted them to read the book and read about confirmation bias and tunnel vision and cognitive dissonance and all these psychological things. And at the end of the book, sort of think, you know what? I just learned a lot about racism because it's those same psychological factors that I talk about that are really the building blocks that cause racism. And so if you can get people to actually focus on that, I think they can actually learn more about racism because they'll just discount it if you tell them it's about racism to begin with.
Mark Godsey's book, again, is called Blind Injustice. A former prosecutor exposes the psychology and politics of wrongful convictions. Mark is a professor of law at the University of Cincinnati and the co-founder and director of the Ohio Innocence Project. Here's Kit in Ashland. Welcome to the Jefferson Exchange.
Thank you, Jeffrey. I just wanted to mention something. Earl Stanley Gardner, who was essentially the creator of Perry Mason, was also an attorney and did exactly the same thing your guest is doing. And I was wondering if he had any awareness of Earl Stanley Gardner actually took students who hadn't passed the bar and they gathered information on questionable convictions and freed, I believe, about 25 people through the justice system. So just curious if your guest knew about Earl.
All right. Thanks for that, Kit. Appreciate it. So the father, Perry Mason, any ways you've run across him or read his books along the way?
You know what? I did not know that, but that is actually fascinating. There's a book coming out by Richard Leo and Tom Wells on the history of the innocence movement. And I haven't read it yet, but that's really fascinating. And I'm going to have to take a look at that because I wasn't aware that, you know, that this was going on that early, and particularly the creator of the Perry Mason show. So thanks for letting me know that.
So there's a triple whammy of psychological flaws you see that work toward the issues that you've raised where people are refusing to accept the fact that somebody might in fact be innocent after they've been proven guilty. Cognitive dissonance, administrative evil, dehumanization come up big. Talk about the cognitive dissonance first and give us a sense of how that plays out in these cases.
Well, I mean, cognitive dissonance is something that everyone suffers from. It's a psychological phenomenon that says that human beings can't hold two conflicting beliefs. It's going to cause a lot of tension and anxiety. And so basically you pick the one that's the most important to your psyche, and then you sort of go into denial about the other one. You know, examples are you know, smoking, and just everyday examples. If you smoke, you can't continually stress out about the negative health benefits. And so a lot of times you'll see people adopt these mantras where they convince themselves, you know, well, yeah, I know I smoke, but I'm quitting next year. You know, as soon as my kids get out of high school, I'm quitting. And then it's, you know, any objective observer after listening to for 10 years realize they're not going to quit. You know, or they come up with an explanation. Well, you know what? I've got, you know, it keeps my weight down and I've got diabetes in my family. So I got to pick my poison. People will, you know, rationalize in order to avoid coming to terms with, you know, bad decisions or things they don't want to accept. And I see a lot of that going on. Like in the Elkins case I just talked about, you know, you have prosecutors and police who are good people, and they've gone into this line of work to, you know, obviously you have your occasional bad apples. We've seen those examples in the news. But by and large, these are people who, you know, went into this line of work to help the public, to help victims of crime and all this kind of thing. And then, you know, you have somebody come back and say, this case you worked on 15 years ago, this guy's poor guy's been in prison for 15 years. Human beings have a hard time accepting that they've made that level of mistake. And so you see them going into denial and start spinning the evidence and coming up with excuses in every little way, as I've already described in the Elkins case, to avoid admitting a mistake.
But, you know, it's one thing that to not have the information or to be confronted with something new to them. But, I mean, you point out cases where prosecutors have confessions from people who say they've done the crimes and don't reveal those.
Yeah, I mean, you know, one of the problems is that, and confirmation bias is the basis of one of my chapters, which is the human tendency to see evidence in a way that just confirms their pre-existing beliefs. When they're convinced they have the right person, and they're 100% convinced of it, and, you know, when they got the conviction, it was on the front page of the newspaper, and they went and took the newspaper and framed it and put it on their wall, and it's been their trophy. And somebody comes back later and says, well, this other guy has confessed and says he's the one that did the crime. I mean, the human tendency in that position is to immediately just go, well, that's a bunch of BS. There's no way that confession's valid, and just not even look into it any further. Don't even bother to check into it. Don't even bother to investigate that person. Just absolutely convince they're right. That's a human failing. And, you know, I've seen that again and again in these cases.
Has the work gotten any easier as Innocence Projects have achieved successes, or do you have the backs up of prosecutors and police now?
It's gone both ways. I mean, in Ohio, when we first started, there was extreme resistance. And in some prosecutors' offices, it has gotten easier, particularly where we've won several cases. And you've got some people who are open-minded, and they've tried to listen. I would say the Cleveland prosecutor's office falls into that category. It's not that I wouldn't call them perfect at this point, but I mean, I think it's a lot better than it was 15 years ago. More recently, they've actually agreed to release a couple of our clients after we presented the evidence instead of just fighting it like they used to. But then there's some other prosecutors' offices who have sort of gone the other way after we've won a couple cases. It just makes them seemingly madder and kind of go deeper into denial, and they just sort of have a knee-jerk reaction. No matter what we present to them, you know, you're wrong is their reaction before they even do any investigation. So it's just a complete closed-minded sort of knee-jerk reaction.
Well, and one of the other things you point out here is administrative evil, which is a fairly strong-sounding term. What do you mean by that?
Yeah, administrative evil is also another psychological phenomenon that explains why good people do bad things when they work in a bureaucracy. I mean, it came out of the Holocaust because you had all these German people. I mean, not all these German people who worked for the Nazis were bad people. I mean, a lot of them, you know, you watch these documentaries, they're regular people that would be like your neighbor. And all of a sudden they're doing these things that are incredibly evil. And the whole sort of country gets conditioned to believe this is okay. It's sort of this bureaucracy that existed. And so it's been studied quite a bit since that time. And the basic notion is that if you're like a prosecutor in a large prosecutor's office like I was, you're just sort of after a while just going through the motions, and you're just responding in a bureaucratic way, in a routine way, to the claims of the defendants, and it becomes very conditioned. And so it almost becomes like monopoly money, like you're playing a game. After a while, you don't really consider people as in their individual humanity that you're dealing with. You're just sort of applying the rules and procedures. And so, you know, part of the problem with these prosecutors, when the evidence proves the guy innocent and they're just refusing to acknowledge it and they're just keeping the person in prison, part of it's denial from cognitive dissonance. And part of it is that they're just conditioned to just go through the motions and apply the rules. And the rule is you always say no to what a defense attorney says. You always fight. And a lot of these people, you know, they're the kind of people that if they were your neighbor, they would, you know, if you were sick, they'd bring you chicken soup or they'd shovel the snow from your driveway, like good people. And they go to work and they do these things which have catastrophic results for good people. I mean, like innocent people. You know, we've had clients who have been proven innocent or still in prison or stay in prison for years and years extra because the prosecutors refused to acknowledge a mistake. That's evil. I mean, if that was your family and that was your child and you had ironclad evidence that the person's innocent, that your child's innocent, and the prosecutors were doing everything they could to keep him in prison, you would say that's evil. But a lot of these prosecutors that are doing that are just sort of going through the motion. They've been conditioned to do that, and they're in denial.
Fascinating stories and disturbing ones as well. In Blind Injustice, a former prosecutor exposes the psychology and politics of wrongful convictions. It's the work of Mark Godsey, who is the founder and co-founder and director of the Ohio Innocence Project. He's at the University of Cincinnati School of Law. We'll come back and talk more with him and take some more phone calls and emails from you when we return to the Jefferson Exchange in a minute 20. Final segment on today's Jefferson Exchange. I'm Jeffrey Riley. Thank you for listening. We're talking to Mark Godsey, who was a federal prosecutor in New York City before he got involved with Innocence Projects, first in Kentucky and then in Ohio, where he helped create the Innocence Project and now runs it out of his office at the University of Cincinnati School of Law. He's written a book called Blind Injustice, a former prosecutor exposes the psychology and politics of wrongful convictions. You can join the conversation on the exchange, 800-838-3760, by phone, by email, jx@jeffnet.org. So we've dealt with cognitive dissonance and administrative evil. Then we get to the subject of dehumanization. And I wonder if whether it's probably never said in such terms, but I mean, is it almost necessary for a prosecutor and for police to dehumanize people, to put them in prison for life or give them a death sentence?
I think so, and I actually acknowledge that. I talk about that in my book. And, you know, I tell stories when I was a prosecutor about how, you know, you sort of, as you're working toward trial and you're trying to send somebody to prison, you sort of get more and more worked up and competitive and become convinced that this person you're trying to prosecute is evil. You know, I tell a story of one case where these three teenagers hijacked basically a Brinks truck, and they had semi-automatic assault weapons, and they took it behind an abandoned building, and they fired the gun into the air, and they stuck the smoking hot barrel of the gun into the driver's mouth and made him unlock the safe, and they took all the money. And two of the perpetrators, after they were arrested, their lawyers contacted me and said, hey, they want to plead guilty, they want to cut a deal, they want to testify against everybody else. So I spent a lot of time working with these two individuals, getting them ready to testify against everybody else at the trial. And these were kids. And, you know, through time working with them and getting their story and getting them ready to testify, I really grew to like them and care about them a whole lot. And I started giving them sort of life lessons. You know, they grew up in the projects and very little education, very little role models. And I sort of became a fatherly figure to them. But at the same time, their friend, who I was prosecuting and I was getting ready to go to trial against, I had this image in my mind that he was this, you know, craven criminal who was out of control and was going to kill somebody if I didn't do something about it. And then I show up for the first pretrial conference before the trial, and they bring him in handcuffs, and he looks like he's, you know, 12 years old, and he was scared to death. And for the first time ever, as a prosecutor, felt really sorry for him. And part of the reason why is that nobody was there in the courtroom. I mean, here's a kid, and he doesn't even have parents show up. And I think what had happened is I had humanized his friends. I had basically grown to like them and appreciate them, even though they had done something terrible. I felt sorry for them. I felt sorry for the circumstances under which they grew up in. And because I had humanized their friends, I sort of got to know him as well, the defendant. And I sort of understood him once he came out, and I saw how young and how scared he was. And so it completely threw me off my game that I was feeling sympathy for this guy I was supposed to be prosecuting. And I was really rattled during the trial. I had a hard time concentrating. You know, normally I'm competitive and fun. You know, my juices are flowing. I love, you know, the battle. But it wasn't like that at all in that case because I'd humanized the guy. So I think that sort of explains it in some ways. To do your job, you've got to step back a little bit. You can't be sitting there being sympathetic to every defendant if you're a prosecutor or police officer. But the problem is that that goes too far, and it becomes institutionalized where you, the point where you're just thinking of every single person you prosecute as guilty and sort of worthless. And, you know, it gets to the point where you've dehumanized your enemy so much that when evidence comes forward years later that one of them's innocent, you don't even really think of them still as a human being, and you can't even really get out of that role, which is another contributing factor. I mean, I'd also talk about in the book, you know, when we would get convictions as a prosecutor, you know, we'd go out and celebrate and party. And I remember one time an NYPD officer drove us across town to a celebratory dinner with the sirens on, you know, like we were rushing to a crime scene, making traffic stop in Manhattan. And we were laughing our heads off in the back seat. And I remember a judge at the time saw us celebrating at one occasion and wrote a note saying, you know, this is inappropriate. You know, it's, you did your job and you did it well, but, you know, his family's innocent. It's tragic for them. And, you know, nobody wins in the criminal justice system. It's not something to celebrate. And at the time, I just thought, this guy's a jerk. You know, what's he talking about? So, but I understand him now.
Well, so you have had a chance to explore, and we've been talking about largely prosecutors here, but you also mentioned in the book that you get some hostility from judges as well as prosecutors, in some cases just for making motions.
Yeah, I mean, I was in a federal prosecutor, so I was in the federal system where the judges are appointed for life by the president. And so you could get a sense sometimes that they were, you know, sort of pro-prosecution or pro-defense, but you never got the sense that there was politics entering the equation because they didn't have to worry about running for re-election. So then I came back to my home state of Ohio, and I started doing innocence work in front of judges who were elected, have to run for re-election in a couple of years, and it was a huge culture shock. So I have a whole chapter called Blind Ambition on the how the election process affects both prosecutors and judges, because, you know, when I started doing these cases, I couldn't tell the difference between the prosecutor and the judge.
Wow.
And then you look on TV during election cycle, and you see the judges, the main person they want to get endorsements for their commercials is the prosecutor. And so they've got to sort of buddy up with the prosecutor between elections to make sure they get that endorsement the next time. You know, anybody from a foreign country that comes and looks at this, any kind of legal scholar, they go, this is crazy. But we're so used to it, we don't even see it.
Has anybody deviated from that line of, like, he'll be tough on crime as prosecutor and all that sort of thing? Has anybody, I guess, in the prosecutorial realm in Ohio come forward and said, you know, I support what's going on at the Innocence Project?
Yeah, we've got a prosecutor in Columbus, Franklin County prosecutor Ron O'Brien, who from the beginning has been totally open. I mean, it's like sitting down with somebody you can have a reasonable conversation with, and he wants to help, he wants to do the right thing. And I think that's just his personality. And he's always been like that. And so you see how institutions work. When you've got a leader at the top like that, it sort of trickles down. And so we see that attitude for the people under him as well. And then more recently in Cleveland, early on we had a pretty tough resistance from that office, but we've seen a softening and trying to be more reasonable and open. And the current prosecutor is saying all the right things and has done a couple of nice things so far. So I think there is change happening, and there's change happening around the country. It's just very, very slow. We've got to continue to sort of yell and scream and raise awareness in order to continue this trajectory.
So we have talked about prosecutors and judges. Let's take this down to the police level now. I mean, you have met officers who had some doubts about the cases. Did they ever come forward willingly?
I'm sorry, you mean in the innocence cases or when I was a prosecutor?
Yeah, in innocence cases.
Yeah, I mean, I don't think I go into all the stories of the book, but I've had a couple of occasions, like the exoneration we got of Glenn Tenney, who was a guy convicted of murder. Actually, that was brought to us by one of the police officers in that department. And he said, I have some grave concerns, and he brought the file, and we investigated it, and we ultimately got an exoneration. And then the case of Dean Gillespie, which I do talk about quite a bit in the book, there were police officers that came forward and sort of reported some of the things that had gone on and were on our side. Now
that was a real jaw dropper because Dean Gillespie, the original police officers assigned to the case, ended up leaving. Did they retire or something?
Yeah, they retired. They What happened is it was a couple of rapes, and the same guy did them in 1988, and they went cold, and the case went cold. They weren't solved. And Dean had a good union job at a GM plant and a clean criminal record, you know, just a good guy. And but he was in pretty intense union battles within his plant, with the management at his plant. And one of the people he was basically developing you know, great animosity with, saw the wanted poster for these unsolved rapes and said, huh, that guy looks a little bit like Dean. So he took took Dean's GM picture and went over to the police department and tried to get him investigated as the rape suspect. And the experienced detective there pretty quickly eliminated Dean as a suspect and said there's no way this guy could have done it. Then those two retire. One moves to Arizona, one moves to Florida. And a new detective takes over the case who happens to be really good friends with Dean's work enemy. And so the work enemy brings Dean's picture over again, and the new detective creates a photo lineup that the Dayton Daily News later called, you know, Dean's picture was all but circled and starred, and got the victims to identify Dean. But the crazy thing is then the file, the earlier file where the original detective had investigated Dean and found evidence eliminating him as a suspect, that disappeared. And so it was only because those officers – the original officers came forward years later and actually testified in federal court, were we able to discover what had gone on and ultimately free Dean.
Are there sanctions in any of these cases? Did anybody get demoted or reassigned or fired outright for misconduct as either police,
you know,
or prosecutors?
That rarely happens, and it all ties into the same problem of denial. If you have prosecutors who are saying that, you know, the case is invalid, this guy's guilty, the Innocence Project's wrong, then even when we win, and like we won Dean's case based on Brady, which is police misconduct, they don't do anything to investigate the officers. I actually wrote a Huffington Post post on this, how this is a national problem that needs to be corrected, because there's nobody to do anything to them except the prosecutors. And when the prosecutors are in denial, they're not going to do anything about it.
You know, we've focused just on the prosecution side and the police side so far. It does take two sides to present a case. What are your thoughts on the quality of the defense work in many of these cases that you end up seeing through Innocence Projects?
Yeah, I mean, that's another thing I talk about quite a bit in the book, is just the uneven playing field. I mean, you've got prosecutors, and, you know, when I was a prosecutor, I had almost unlimited resources for experts and CSI-type forensic analysis to be done and investigators to hit the street and interview witnesses and, you know, most defendants have a public defender with little to no funds to spend on the case. And I think that was, I hope your listeners have watched Making a Murder. If not, they should, because I think it's the best film or series that documents this problem. You know, in that case, Stephen Avery had just won a civil settlement and had a lot of money, and so he was able to get great attorneys. But Brendan Dassey was forced to rely on public defenders, who basically sold them down the river and did very little work on the case. I mean, I don't mean to disparage public defenders. A lot of them are great. A lot of them are good-hearted people who are doing the best they can. But, I mean, the system is just imbalanced. And so Making a Murder really depicted the disparity in defense between people who actually have money and those who don't. And if you don't have money, it's not a fair fight.
You know, we talked largely about DNA evidence, though, but, I mean, obviously there's a good-sized section of the book about how unreliable witness testimony can be, especially when you're seeing somebody for really a matter of seconds in a really stressful kind of environment. Does witness testimony still count a lot, despite our knowledge of how shaky it can be?
Yeah, people still, I mean, despite the fact that it's a leading cause of wrongful conviction, I think in 75% of the exonerations, somebody testified as an eyewitness and they were later proven dead wrong. The public still generally believes that if somebody says, hey, I saw the crime and that's the guy who did it, I'm 100% certain that that's ironclad evidence. And recent discoveries and breakthroughs in human memory and how we now understand how malleable human memory is, how susceptible to suggestion it is. There's study after study where, you know, show a video of a crime to people, and then the officers can just ask a few questions and really change the person's memory. You know, like, you know, wasn't it a blue getaway car? Previously they said it was a white getaway car, but just the officer asking that question and suggesting blue will get them to change their statement. And then all of a sudden, you know, they remember it as blue and they testify that it was blue. And so it's very easy to understand how eyewitnesses are led astray and end up making mistakes. It's not nearly as reliable as we once believed. There's easy steps we can take to make it more reliable, But one of the, and I talk about that in the book, I go through all the different reforms that are necessary. But one of the frustrating things is there's so much resistance from the system that the reforms are going very slowly.
Well, it's not a doomsday book. You say at the start there is reason for hope and reform, but what kinds of things would you like to see happen?
Well, I mean, there's so many different things. I mean, just the training of police officers and prosecutors, the awareness of this. But, you know, just even like an eyewitness identification, there's ways that you can cut down on the suggestiveness so that it's called double blind. The officer who shows the pictures to the witness, to the eyewitness, doesn't know which one is the right answer. So there can be no even subconscious or unconscious suggestion. There can be no feedback afterwards that changes the memory because the officer doesn't know. There's easy ways that so that sort of it removes the any influence that might occur, which is one of the things that causes wrongful convictions. You know, false confessions, that's hard for most people to wrap their minds around, but innocent people falsely confessing is one of the leading causes of wrongful conviction. And you could see that again in Making a Murderer with the Brendan Dassey case. And recording interrogations, have video cameras on. We have that technology now. It's very inexpensive. It can be done. You do that from beginning to end, and it becomes much easier to see when a false confession happens. Easy step that can cut down on wrongful convictions. And the forensics, I mean, we didn't get into that, but there's all kinds of problems with forensics in this country. And there are easy steps that we can take to make them more reliable and more accurate, but that's being resisted.
Ultimately, a fairly upbeat look at the fact that there is hope there, but boy, your jaw's going to be on the floor for a good bit of the book if you decide to read it. Blind Injustice, a former prosecutor exposes the psychology and politics of wrongful convictions. That is Mark Godsey, who is a professor of law at the University of Cincinnati and the co-founder and director of the Ohio Innocence Project. Mark, thanks so much for joining us today on The Exchange. We appreciate it.
Thanks for having me on. And if listeners are interested in learning more, they can go to my Facebook page, Blind Injustice. It's a group where I'm putting updates and information about this on a several times a day.